You don't mind if we record?
Well, I don't like that stuff, you know.
It won't be held against you.
That's all right.
So this is, let's see, what's today? Today's July 16th, and Ken Kellerman. I'm here with Ted Reif, former Associate Director for Administration. Is that right? And Ellen Boughton, you know Sierra.
Yep,
right. Okay. Just to get things in proper chronological order or know where we stand, when did you start at NRAO? What year?
1959. I was invited to come to, well, Louis Burchill, who was the controller of AUI, and Frank Callender, who had only been at the NRAO for a few months.
He was
at the NSF.
And he was the...
He was a business manager. Well, they had these crazy titles. Chairman of the Administrative Department, or Administration Department, I guess. And there were three divisions. Heeshan was chairman of the Astronomy Department. Findlay was chairman of the Electronics Department. Callender, chairman of the Administrative Department. But Burchill and Callender came to Charleston and interviewed me. Now the contact.
Burchill was from AUI.
Burchill was controller of AUI from Brookhaven. And well, it was sort of funny the way I made the contact. I was controller of a department store in Charleston and two other little smaller corporations, which is family owned thing. Well, it was about a $5 million department store, which in 1959 was a fairly good-sized store. And the guy who'd been tax commissioner before, Joe Soto, he was now, or then, was executive director of the State Chamber of Commerce. So he called me and said, and I'd met him when I was a budget analyst with the state, and he said, you know, up at Green Bank, they're building a space station of some sort. And he said, somebody from New York called him, I guess he gave me Burchill's name, and said they needed somebody with accounting background, business background, knew the state of West Virginia tax laws and this. And he said, you're the guy I thought of. He said, now, we've given the name to a headhunter over here, and I'm going to call him and give him your name. I said, well, I don't. Space station? I said, you mean Sugar Grove, don't you? He said, no, no. I said, this is a different outfit altogether. I said, this is not the Navy or military. And so I said, well, I don't know whether I'm interested or not. Well, he did call the guy. The guy called my house, talked to my wife. I go home, Clara, and she said, some guy called and said he was interested in talking to you about, you know, this job. I said, I don't think I'd be interested. I was happy where I was and so forth. Yeah, I want to talk to him, you know. So my wife insisted. So Burchill and Callender came to Charleston, interviewed me. That was in, I believe, February of 59. Could have been March. And Callender didn't have much to say. His background was political science, and so they needed... but he had been very instrumental in when he worked at the NSF and getting the NRAO going. But they needed someone to, with business, pure business background. And Burchill led the conversation. He said, well, there are two major things that this job was entailed, which he was interviewing me for. Said, Brookhaven was doing most of the accounting and personnel stuff for the NRAO. We got to move that down, set it up down here. He said he didn't want Brookhaven to have anything to do with it. He said that was a separate contract altogether. He said, second thing is, he said, we're building this 140-foot telescope. He said, I don't know what the problems are, but we got problems. And he said, so I'll need someone that has an auditing and financial background to go to Canton, Ohio once every month and pre-audit the billings of E.W. Bliss, who was built contractor on the telescope. And he said, so that's the part of the job. I said, well, who would I be working for? He said, well, two people, really. He said, Mr. Callender, locally, and he said, and me, the corporation controller. He said, financial stuff, you come directly to me. He said, administrative matters locally, Callender. And, well, it's okay. So, went back home and, they came back home, and in, I think it was March or April, they invited me to come up and look the place over. Wasn't much going on. The foundation of the 140 foot was in, and so forth. I said, well, okay, we talked then how much you're going to pay me for this kind of thing. And we settled on that, and so I went back home, and about 2 weeks later, Callender called me and said, oh, come running. So I said, well, I can't get away for about 2 months because they'd have an audit of the books where I was working. And so in August, I came to work.
Now, I didn't realize Callender came from the NSF.
Yeah, he was worked for Jack Luton, who was the administrator at the NSF, he was, but Callender was a pretty good man. He had problems when he got here, but I think he'd only worked in government. That was
So he resigned his government
left
position.
The NSF, yeah, he couldn't do that today. They have that waiting period, you know.
Right, from, right.
But he, back then he could do that. And, yeah, he was, I don't know what his title was. They only had 100 or some few people up at the NSF then. So when I came in, the first, like, 2 weeks that I was here, he and I went to Washington. He wanted to introduce me to all the the people. They were in the old AEC building down on Constitution Avenue. I don't know if you were.
No.
They'd probably moved by the
they were
time.
In G Street by the time I came.
Yeah. So I met Alan Waterman, who was the director of the foundation, and Jack Luton, who was the administrator of the NSF. Good friends of ours. I don't think Aaron Rosenthal was there yet. I think I met him a little. Most interesting person I met was Vernice Anderson. Did you know Vernice Anderson?
No.
Well, I just read the book, The Truman Years or the Truman Presidency, I don't remember the name of it or not. And Frank, and she was, by the way, she was secretary to the Science Board at the, and became the administrator of the Science Board or administrative aide or something like that. But when I met her, Vernice Anderson, I recognized the name. I said, oh, you're the lady behind the curtain. And so you know the story?
No.
Okay. Well, when President Truman flew to Wake Island to meet with Douglas MacArthur in the early part of the Korean War, after the Incheon landing and so forth, I read the book, and I got two stories on this. One, you know, MacArthur was such a megalomaniac that he kept his, this is the story, first story I got, the plane, he kept his plane over the horizon until Truman's plane landed.
Oh,
so Truman would have to
bring right, yeah, right, right, right.
Well, I asked Vernice about that. She said, that's not exactly true. She said, MacArthur got there first, but he waited, made Truman wait for a half hour on the plane before he went out to greet him. And she said, no, I won't say any more about that. And so I saw her several times there. But it was a very interesting, that was an interesting side story there of an interesting person I met.
So where was the NSF located then? You said on Constitution Avenue.
Yeah, on there's an old Atomic Energy Commission building. It was small, it wasn't as big as this, well, about the size of this building. But I remember the room that we were in, it was sealed, and or the room where we met up there. It was sealed and everything. You could see that there wasn't any bugging in that building at all. Yeah, they moved out down on 18th Street, I believe. I remember I stayed
and
at the Roger
G Street,
Smith Hotel.
G Street, G and 18, yeah.
Yeah, and just walked down there. And so we had the foundation began expanding, and we had Randy Robertson, whom you, I'm sure you must have known, Randy.
And what was his
title? Was head of math and physics, whatever, APS, I guess they called it. And, I don't know, Paul Scheer came along a little bit later.
And tell us about him, because I've read some, there's been correspondence with
Scheer.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't have any too much to do with Jerry Tate. Worked with Paul Scheer a lot. I can't remember all the details. This had to do with the 140-foot telescope, I do believe. And Scheer and Aaron Rosenthal. Rosenthal was controller of the NSF. And after we went through a lot of the to-ing and fro-ing on what you're going to do with about the 140-foot telescope, Scheer and I guess Drew was still here then, I'm not sure whether he had. But anyway, Jerry Tape had gotten involved in it as an AUI.
Was he president yet, or?
No. Jerry wasn't president. He was deputy director at Brookhaven.
Ah, right. Okay.
And what's his name? You have to excuse me because things slipping anymore. Finances was a big problem after we decided how we were going to build the 100,000. We're going to get out from under this bliss. Rosenthal, he managed to find a way to get some, first $3 million to start bailing it out. The second $3 million. But Paul Scheer, he worked with AUI directly. And I guess at that time, Ted Reynolds was president of AUI.
Yes, and I ran across a letter from Reynolds to Emerson, chewing Emerson out for going beyond his authority.
Yeah,
and then he wrote to Scheer about the same thing or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember the details.
Yeah. Well, it really got messed. Now I'm getting into the 100. You wanted something that you noted.
That's all right.
The 140-foot telescope. That was to be the observatory, as you noted, I think, on a number of occasions. One of my first jobs was to go to Canton, Ohio, and see what kind of bookkeeping you guys are doing. The progress of the work, Spencer Greenwood was at Canton and Plant, and he had a little book. He'd keep notes on number of people on this job and so forth and so on.
He worked for?
AUI. Oh, well, for NRL.
Yeah, okay.
And so I was to consult with Greenwood and see, how his...
He worked for you, or?
Well, no, he worked for the project, the 140.
Ah.
At the time, he was working for Emerson. Emerson was the project manager.
Yes.
I guess acting deputy director of the NRAO, because Lloyd Berkner was acting director of the NRAO, and he was also president of AUI at that particular moment in time. And I went to Canton, and the progress of the work, it was still...
This is right after you came.
Yeah.
So
within a month.
Okay,
maybe 2 months.
Late 59 that we're talking about?
Yeah, probably August.
Okay.
September.
Okay.
About the time we put Struve on the payroll, as I recall. And poor old Otto Struve got caught up in all this stuff right off the bat. But anyway, Spencer Greenwood, I would check his records against what Bliss would give me if they were going to bill us for. And I couldn't make heads or tails of it. And I figured Spencer, he was pretty meticulous, and his records are pretty good. So I went up and talked with the controller at Bliss, and I said, well, what's this, what's that? Talked about engineering variance. And I said, it's a big variance. They got any company, a big company has an engineering department, And they have little jobs that they have to do in a house, like they have to design a new toilet for their administrative offices or something. Well, they don't even charge that. And so after you get through at the end of the day or the end of the week, there's some hours that's not accounted for. So what they do is they just take and spread it over every job. Fair enough, you know, you're going to wind up paying for it anyway.
That's what I do.
Yeah, you do. Everybody does it. But ours was seemed extraordinarily large, and so I asked the controller, I'm trying to remember his name, and I can't do that. I said, well, why is it? I said, can I check, see your how you're charging to all departments? He said, no, you can't do that. He said, we've got Navy working here, and he said, that's classified, you're not entitled to see that. And so, and I said, well, this is a hell of a big variance you're charging to the NREO. And I called Lou Burchill and told him, I have a funny feeling. I said, now you want me to write you a memo about this? And he said, no, just stand fast. He said, we were having a meeting the next few days about it with Reynolds and so forth. So I heard nothing else, and I got the train back to White Sulphur Spring, back to Green Bank, because you know what the travel was like then. And when I went in, Frank Callender came up, and he had a letter in his hand. It was from Reynolds, Ted Reynolds, to the president of Bliss, saying, we're going to change the contract from a fixed price to cost plus. And I thought, what in the hell? I mean, that's a license to steal if I ever saw it, you know. And Frank says, yeah, he didn't figure out what was going on. And so I called Louis Burchill and asked, well, yes, what the hell's going on? He said, don't worry about it. Another letter's on the way. The other letter was from Reynolds to Bliss, canceling the contract. NSF, he hadn't consulted with anybody about changing the cost plus contract. And so the NSF, Rosenthal just blew a stack. So
Reynolds, what was his background?
He was at MIT.
MIT.
Or Harvard.
Harvard,
yeah. I don't know what his exact position was at Harvard.
Science or?
I think so, but I. You know, yeah.
First name?
You can look him up.
Yeah, what was his first name? Ted.
No, Ted.
Ted, same.
Yeah. Whether it was Edward or Theodore,
right.
I don't know. Whether that's okay. Either one worked.
So it was AUI, I'm sorry, it was NSF. That instigated canceling the contract with Bliss?
Well, whether they instigated it or not, they were really, the canceling the cost plus provision, they certainly was involved in that, because that, to me, was...
Oh, so that's all, they just canceled that, they went back then to the fixed price?
I think things got so tense there for a bit that they said, well, okay, let's... And Bliss was just not performing.
Yeah.
They just weren't performing. So Reynolds, to his credit, he was somehow or another related to Stone and Webster engineering outfit. Stone and Webster was just finishing up the power plant down here at Lake Anna, the first nuclear power plant in Virginia. And so they had a reputation to very good. But he put us in contact with them, and so we made the decision then that we would be our own contractor, and got Max Small out of Brookhaven.
This is a couple years later, though, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, no, not 2 years. Heeshan was the director
right.
At that point. Struve had decided.
Yeah. So.
Well. Dave may have been acting director at that moment, at that particular
okay.
moment in time.
But yeah, but it was after Struve.
Yeah, it was after Struve.
Yeah.
Well, Struve, yeah, he had, you remember he'd fallen and broken his arm, I think, or shoulder or something. He had been in the hospital over here. And Struve was a little bit upset the way things were going with that. I think. If it hadn't had all the problems with the 140-footer, he would have been a very good director. He worked well with the staff, and he liked his students. And I liked him. I got along just fine. And at any rate, then we just, the decision was made to go with our own setup. The Max would be the project manager. Stone and Webster would do the complete the engineering. A lot of that telescope had to be re-engineered. And so we assigned anybody that we needed to on the job, on that job. And Stone and Webster did a good job for us. Now, I was the only person that with the financial stuff, and I said, I don't know, we're going to handle this. We've got to hire some more people, and no, you can't do that. Okay, we're contracted. So Stone and Webster, they furnished us a guy, I can't remember his name now, a business type guy, and put him in the plant up at Canton to inventory all the material and say, this can't go to the telescope, can't go into West Virginia, this we can salvage and so forth. And there was a reason for that, which I think I put them on to. Was, well, the NREO or AUI is tax exempt in West Virginia. Contractors are not. And so anything of value that's brought into the state, the contractor has to pay a tax on it. So this guy, he did a real good job. The old sphere that was thrown out and so forth, a lot of money tied up in that. So he did a real good job for us on that. And Max, Max was very good at what he did. He and I had some knockdown dragouts, as Heesham called them, and he had to resolve them. Max wanted his own chart of accounts, his own accountants, his own personnel people, and so forth. And it was only 100 yards down the road from where I was sitting. I said, no, we don't need two of those. I can handle that in my office. And so he goes to Heesham. Heesham says, well, Rife is the guy that I'm relying on to do this. And that was it. And so we worked that out. All right.
Was he on loan from Brookhaven? Or did mm-hmm.
Yeah, we transferred him to the NREO payroll.
Oh, okay.
And he and his wife moved. They right. moved into the old Hardy house up there.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And Max did a good job for us. And we finally got that thing straightened out. But it was pretty much of a mess from the beginning. Ned Ashton, he got a little bit out of sorts with the way he wanted to do any redesign that was necessary. But
he did the original design.
He did the original design, yeah. He was an interesting guy. He's from Iowa State University, I think. And he and his wife, Gladys, they would come down to the, and the first few weeks that he was here, he came down, and he had rented a cabin up at Bartow in the woods up there, and he and his wife would stay in that. And he had Dick Emerson and me up for dinner, cookout type thing, and he wasn't too happy with some of the AUI people. Berkner, to be exact, Berkner was fairly bombastic, you know, he was pushing him, he was playing on me, you know, what can I do for him? I could see through that, but they were nice people. One of the funny on this with his wife Gladys, when we built the residence hall and the cafeteria, you know, the ladies' room and the men's room right off to the side, well, they had not put these fire sprinklers in the residence hall. Well, Lloyd Berkner saw that and he said, "Well, that's crazy." So he took the plans, laid them out, and just drew a line down two sides of the thing, said, put these sprinklers in, and told the contractor that. That's why you get sprinkler heads in the showers in the residence hall. I mean, they were you bought them standard, you know, and wherever they fit, that's where they went. Well, at any rate, the plumbers hooked the sprinkler system up to the same line that was on the ladies' commode in the ladies' room, the commode in the ladies' room. Now, these sprinklers, they set off is when the pressure drops. Yeah. If the pressure drops on that pipe that's in there, sprinklers, well, the sprinklers don't set off, but the alarm sets off. That's what happened. Well, anyway, we had dinner. Gladys goes to the restroom. You know what happened now. And there's a big gong in the cafeteria. You remember that one, the bell?
I think so.
Okay. Well, no one had used it before. They just hooked it up that day. So Mrs. Ashton, Gladys, she goes in. Now, she had dentures. And she was in the bathroom. She was cleaning her dentures after dinner, I guess. And but at the same time, she flushed the commode. And that gong starts out. And, of course, that's kind of like all hell was breaking loose in that restroom. And she come running out. Ned was going to just carrying her teeth in her hand. So, I don't know why I remembered that, of all things.
How well did you know Berkner?
Berkner?
Yeah.
Well, I worked with him on a couple of little things. Getting a post office in Green Bank was one. And settling up the John Carroll.
Oh, there was no post office in Green Bank before?
Yeah, but we needed a new. They needed a new, and they just couldn't handle it. He wanted to know. And
Is this story true that the grade of the post office, the level, was upgraded because of the weight? That they stuff they carried, and that was because of 140-foot castings or something?
I heard that.
I don't know.
No, but what happened on that Margaret, it was Frank and my secretary, Margaret Irvin, and Berkner was down at Green Bank, and he'd mailed himself a package a week before to Green Bank, and when he got there, the package wasn't there. So he came in, and Frank wasn't in the office, but he asked me, he said, I want to borrow your secretary. Okay, so he went to dictate a letter to Summerfield, Postmaster General, about that lousy postal service into Green Bank, and this, that, and the other, the post office, how crummy it was. Within a week, the guy was in talking to Frank and me about, well, where do you want the post office? Do you want it right across from your main gate or whatnot? And so we said, no, let's put it down in Green Bank where it was or something. So Berkner was, as I say, when he was bombastic, he really got bombastic. So that got the post office. And the other one was John Carroll. You know that story. John Carroll was a engineer at Brookhaven. He was assigned to the NREO. And on a Sunday, he was going to church in Marlin. He was Catholic, and that's the only place where he could, the nearest place. And he was running late, and down at Dunmore, they've changed the road there now, he'd come up over the hill, head on another car.
Yeah,
it was Berkner's wife and daughter. And it was a real mess. Carroll was killed. And it was a GSA car he was driving. And Mrs. Berkner got a helicopter in and brought her UVA. And she was in really bad shape. The daughter, she was banged up pretty badly and brought her too. But they both lived, of course. But John Carroll.
When was this?
That was right before I came there. No, but I got caught up in having to settle up some of the stuff.
Right.
Particularly with GSA, that car. Oh, that became a mess. Callender came in. He said, I don't know what to do about this. So he threw a file down on my desk. And the question was it a misuse of a government vehicle? And I got a hold of Peter Rathbone, who was assistant secretary and counsel for AUI, And he said, well, let's go argue on this one. And so he and I went down and argued that if a guy is away from home on temporary duty, going to church on Sunday, if he's really religious, is a part of our duty to see that he can go to church. And they accepted that. They said, you have to pay for the car, the loss of the car. And that was all no fines or anything like that. And the other thing was, and Rathbone, he handled it, John Carroll, we had, back then you had to pay for your life insurance. It was 35 cents a thousand or something like that for the additional insurance. And you could reject it if you wanted to, but we had to have it in writing that you rejected it. And so John Carroll rejected this. And, but his wife, she claimed that he should receive that anyway, the additional amount. And so I had to get involved in that. And finally, the AUI said, well, we'll make a Solomon-like decision, give her the money. So it was a bit of a mess.
Anyway, back to Berkner. I mean, everything I've read about him, I mean, he had a tremendous background.
Oh, yeah.
He did all sorts of things. But he left shortly after Struve did.
That's right. He went to Southwestern.
Right, Texas.
Graduate Center in Texas or something. Yeah, he was an interesting little guy. I didn't have that much to do with him, but a few times we did. And he gave Callender a hard time because the roads were unpaved up there. It was just a mud hole, that place, in 1959.
The site or the public road?
The site.
Right.
And so we had a meeting with Berkner and the staff, I guess, at least the administrative staff. Berkner said, I want those damn roads paved, and I don't want any excuses. So I'll get that passed. Well, a month or three or 4 weeks later, another meeting. Berkner back. Nothing happened on the roads. And all I knew was really giving Callender a hard time. Frank says, well, Lloyd, says, I told you that it was, we got a lot of heavy stuff coming in here, and there's no point in paving those things until it's dried up and so forth. And he said, you stood there and you agreed with me. And Berkner said, well, what do you mean I agreed with you? He said, well, you nodded when I explained it to you. He said, that didn't mean I agreed with you. That meant I understood. So that's the kind of a guy he was.
Now, is this when he was acting director?
And president.
And president. Yeah, he was president.
Yeah, he was saying that was all the same thing. Yeah.
So he did come to Green Bank.
Oh, yeah, he came down regularly. About every month there. And then.
This is before Struve.
Well, yeah. Well, Struve came in September, I believe it was.
September
of 59.
59.
And so Berkner continued for, I don't know how often he would, continued with, he was interested in the project, certainly. And then when he resigned, it was after his wife, that he was pretty torn up about that. It was understandable. And he went back to Texas. I heard nothing further from him after that.
So you don't think he left because of the 140-foot mess and the difficulty in finding a director? When Struve left?
Well, Struve left, it was just, that was pretty, not much was happening. Struve was complaining a lot about people didn't do what he told him to do or something, you know, that's not the right words, but he couldn't get a grasp of the thing because everybody was focusing on the 140-foot telescope and other things were just floating around. But Struve did a lot of things. He wanted the student base at the NREO, and we went through that undergraduate research.
Now, I was surprised that Finley was in charge of that.
Well, Finley was the deputy director under Struve. When Struve came in, he wanted Armin Deutsch as his deputy. And George came to Green Bank and spent about a week with us.
What was their connection, or where did he get?
I'm not sure. I think Dorch may have been a student of Struve's at Chicago when Struve was there for a while.
Now we're talking what year?
Well, this was in 59.
59. When it's,
yeah. And Dorch came, and he stayed several days with us, I remember.
Because I've seen his name turn up in the visiting committee.
Yeah.
Or trustee. They, and I've always wondered, because he was at Mount Wilson Palomar when
That's
I was
right.
a graduate student at Caltech. And
That's
he
right.
had no...
Well, later. That was later, though.
Well, I started in 59.
Well, it's about
yeah.
that time, I guess.
But he had no involvement or interest in radio astronomy.
No, but Struve...
So I was surprised to learn some years later that he was involved in
yeah.
that area.
Yeah. Yeah, and he... Came to Green Bank. He spent some time with us and with the Struvers, mostly. You know, that was. I think he was a student of Struvers, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. But anyway, that's who Struve wanted as his deputy. But he, Deutsch didn't take it. So then they named Findlay as his deputy. And they moved in to where the fiscal office was there in this Green Bank building. And John Struve had to assign something to somebody, and so he assigned John a UGRPP, I remember, an undergraduate research participation program.
Yeah, because yeah, just the day before I ran across something. Findlay was the contact. The
That's right.
PI, and I was surprised because, you know.
Yeah. Well, the other job John had at that particular time was the Little Bighorn.
Yes.
And he was.
He was also head of electronics or engineering or something.
No, after he when he became deputy director, put Hain in charge, which did away with those. Heeshan and Struve got together and did away with these chairmanships.
Right.
And. Heeshan never did like him, he said, and Struve certainly didn't like him. He said, hell, an observatory is an astronomy department. And so Hain was named head of the electronics.
Who hired Hain?
I think Berkner. Berkner did. Because there's a letter in the file. Hain had to leave. Remember the old H. Veaches?
Yeah, yeah.
You can only stay... So
right.
long. Then you had to leave at least a year.
Right.
So Hain went back to Norway, to Chalmers, I guess. I'm not sure whether he went to Chalmers or not. After his
he first came as a visitor, a postdoc.
Or he was a postdoc.
Postdoc.
Well, as a research associate.
Research associate, we call it. Yeah.
And he went back and get the letter out that Berkner wrote. I told Hain, I said, I read that letter, and I said, I thought they were bringing Albert Einstein over here. Thought, boy, I never had such glowing.
But you had to do that to get the visa.
Yeah.
Still
so
good.
A year later, here, Hain, Rondi, and their kids came back. So Hain then became head of the electronics division at that point. John may have been acting head, but he was deputy director at that point. And... he was doing some research with the horn
right.
after it was Cassiopeia or whatever
yeah.
it was that he was doing. John always worried about it. He couldn't figure out what the cost of the horn was, and that was a job he assigned to me when I first came, trying to figure that one out. It was crazy. And John also started working about that time on the LFST, and which the 300-footer foot telescope came out of that. And that was while Struve was, did the groundbreaking and all that. I remember we going down to the field down there on that one. So John was contributing a lot to...
Now who hired him?
Findlay.
Yeah.
Berkner.
Berkner.
Yeah.
And what was their connection? How did he know about him?
I really don't know. I really don't. John, had, you know, during the war, he had been in a lot of... done some. A lot of radar work, and I think in India.
India, yeah.
And I really don't know. But Berkner was the one that somehow I think he may have sent out word to friends that he knew, and some said we need an electronic hurt, and Finley's name popped up. John, in the early days, he made a lot of good contributions to the play. Things got a little rough later on, but you know, the horn, and the 300 foot, and 36 footer Tucson, and he would do the job, get halfway through the job, he'd lose interest in it, somebody else would have to take it over. That's the way it seemed to me, but that may not be true. But so the organization was Struve, director, and Finley, deputy director, and Heeshan was. I think Heeshan was head of telescope operations. I'm not absolutely sure. The new titles that came in, maybe he was senior scientist, and Drake was head of telescope operations. I don't know.
I thought he stayed on as head of the astronomy division.
Well, I guess he was. Yeah. But we changed. Heeshan hated organizational charts. You probably know that. And job titles and things didn't impress him in the least. And we had the NSF and AUI kept telling him, we need organization charts and so forth. And so Dave and I, we got together and came up with one. It would be two parts, or three parts, actually. There's electronic, or the technical services, administration, and basic research.
Because when I came, it was called basic research.
Yeah, and a director. And the basic research went straight to
the director. That's right.
And the other two, which was Hayne and me,
we'd
go to the director. And so that was the sort of the management organization. Very simple and pretty good. It worked anyway, you know. And so Dave, he's the hiring and so forth. I don't know, Struve, I guess he was, initially he was involved in some of the hiring, although I don't recall too much. Struve was an interesting guy. I had several. Well, one of the things he wanted me to talk to the state about, seeing if they could was it possible to get a little piece of land up in Ball Knob to put a little optical telescope up there. And what he wanted to do was students could go actually see a source as well as hear the source, you know. So I checked with the State Department that bought Ball Knob, and they said, well, we can certainly work, I'm sure we can work out something. And Struve liked that because there were no lights, pollution, or anything up there. So nothing ever came of that. Heeshan and Koshimen and I was chairman of the CAS committee that got this railroad started up there. So I got a motor car and took Heeshan and Koshu. We went up to Ball Knob as far as we could get one day. And Heeshan asked me, I said, could I get up there? And I said, it's the only way you can get up there then.
Right. On the train tracks.
Yeah, on the railroad track. And Heeshan didn't say so, but I think he wanted to satisfy Struve that, okay, you could do it, but why? You know, that he wasn't very enthusiastic about it at all. I don't think any of the staff was. So, but Struve, I recall when we settled up the Bliss contract, there was a check to pay to Bliss for $1,300,000. And all checks had to have two signatures, of that size, had to have two signatures. Mine was always on it, and one other person, either director or Heeshan or somebody else. Anything under $10,000, just they used a signature plate. Well, at any rate, Struve, they had a every morning about 10 o'clock, the scientific staff, it's like an old chicken or little biddies, you know, head for the cafeteria for coffee about 10 o'clock. So I had this check for $1,300,000 to pay to E.W. Blitz. So I signed it, and I walked out to find somebody else to sign it, and Struve was just coming out of his office. And there was that place where I had the mail there. And I said, "Ah, Dr. Struve, just the person I need to see." I said, "Could I get your signature, please?" And he said, "Oh, sure." And I laid this down. I said, "Just put your John Hancock right there." And he signed the check, handed it back to me. And he looked at me and said, "My name's not John Hancock." Oh, boy. Oh, God. Here, I presumed to a familiarity that really didn't exist, you know. And I said, oh, boy.
Did you call him Dr. Struve?
I was calling him Dr. Struve.
And did everybody, Dave Heeshan?
Yeah, Dave did, too. Dave usually would use professor.
Okay, right. But still it was formal.
Yeah. But Callender would call him Otto and so forth. I thought that was presumptuous. You know? But
and how did he refer to call the staff, you and
he? Well, he just called me Ted.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, but anyway, I felt pretty small after Struve. So I go back in my office and I'm sitting there and looking across. And here he's walking across the way. He goes in, just a couple of minutes later, here he comes back, walking very fast. He came into my office, and he said, "I want to apologize."
Oh.
And then I said, "Well, that's okay, you know," something like that. And he said, "Can I see that check?" He said, "Can I take it with me?" He took it over and showed the staff. He said, "Now there's power, what, a million?" Go ahead.
This alarm is going to go off. We're having a fire alarm.
Fire.
Oh.